American Free Press Audio Edition number 23 and 24, June 3 and 10, 2019. Meeting site revealed most powerful secret society will meet in Montreux, Switzerland. By Mark Anderson. The Bilderberg Group's anonymous press office has finally released the dates and location of the 67th Bilderberg Conference in 65 years. It will be held May 30 – June 2 at the Fairmontly Montreux Palace on the shores of Lake Geneva in Montreux, Switzerland. Also released were the official lists of topics and attendees, which includes what appears to be the largest contingent of American government-affiliated attendees in recent memory and, quite possibly, in the history of Bilderberg. This super-secretive gathering meets annually. Its members include uber wealthy, highly influential figures from the fields of government, high finance, central banking, high tech, European royalty, large corporations, think tanks, academia, and the derelict mass media. The confab consists of a series of talks, which amount to brainstorming sessions. From those sessions, and from the networking that happens before, during, and after Bilderberg's annual meeting, the gathered information, in an off-the-record manner, is quietly disseminated via a private network in order to maintain, consolidate, and expand the transnational world government grid, accompanied by heavy privatization of public assets and systems. Of note, this year's attendees list includes President Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner among the 130 people from 23 nations who are attending by invitation only. There have been rumors of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo attending, though his name does not appear on the official list. Notably, Bilderberg's steering committee used to invite hardcore neoconservative Zionists Richard Perlin, Paul Wolfowitz, but that's not been the case in recent years. Among the list of attendees are a cross-section of people with military and strategic duties, James H. Baker and Matthew Daniels from the DOD, Matthew Pottinger and Matthew Turpin from the NSC, and James O. Ellis from the National Space Council. See a projected attendees list on page 17, ed. The participation of Baker and his fellow travelers from the defense and strategy realm makes sense, given that five of Bilderberg's 11 topics this year deal with strategic matters: a stable strategic order, China, Russia, the importance of space, and cyber threats. The weaponization of social media and the ethics of artificial intelligence topics also fit into the strategic mold. The remaining four topics this year are: what next for Europe, climate change and sustainability, the future of capitalism, and Brexit. The just concluded European elections are all but assured to be an unannounced topic this year, due in part to spectacular populist gains. America's 2020 elections will surely come up, too. American propagandist David E. Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times, will be among this year's media representatives at Bilderberg. These journalists will have a front row seat at the secretive discussions, the details of which won't be reported as having come from Bilderberg. Writers and editors for The Washington Post, Financial Times, Bloomberg and The Economist also are represented this year, among several other news anchors and media company owners. Such reporters, like the government officials with whom they mingle, always leave the public trust at the door upon entering Bilderberg, where the hotel of choice is completely sealed off from real reporters, normal customers, and the general public, and surrounded by heavily armed private security and publicly financed police. Around the world, nationalism is on the rise. 2 issues ago, we reported on the front page of our May 6th and 13th edition that we were having trouble locating the site of this year's annual Bilderberg meeting. Roving editor Mark Anderson penned that report, speculating that, with all the bad news globalists have been facing lately, they were most likely laying low and were probably looking at Ottawa, Canada as the spot where the world's top movers and shakers would meet behind locked and guarded doors to discuss the most important issues of the day and figure out ways to profit off of them. News of a Bilderberg meeting in Europe at a time of such strong anti-globalist sentiment and developments could prove damaging for the group, especially in terms of bringing back unwanted, widespread publicity about the secretive gathering, something the group has labored to control and reduce as much as possible in its more than 6 decades of existence, wrote Mark. who has been covering the shadowy group since the death of Bilderberg hound Jim Tucker on April 26, 2013. It was a tough call for us to run that article. Since 1954, Bilderberg has been trying to gather in total secrecy, and, for the first couple decades, that worked well for them. Since the 1970s, though, editors and reporters connected to American Free Press have without fail forced the moneyed elites out of the closet, exposing their nefarious plans, and the world has been a better place for it. This year, though, we were worried. It was looking more and more like they had successfully clamped down on past leaks that disclosed their five-star hideaways. Thankfully, however, it was Bilderberg itself that spilled the beans. In an effort to become more transparent, Bilderberg created its own simple website a few years ago that lists its attendees and vaguely references key topics discussed at the gatherings. We monitor that website closely, and, sure enough, on or around May 27th, only 4 days before the meeting was set to kick off, the anonymous individuals who maintained the Bilderberg meeting's website posted the following: "The 67th Bilderberg meeting will take place from May 30th to June 2nd, 2019 in Montreux, Switzerland. About 130 participants from 23 countries have confirmed their attendance. A link to the list of this year's attendees was also added, as was colorful verbiage about the group's storied history and its agenda. The truth is, Mark's initial report from early May couldn't have been more prescient, given what just transpired in elections in Europe and around the world. In late May, the European Union held parliamentary elections, which take place every 5 years. Some 400 million people voted across Europe to send their representatives to the European Union, and, according to published reports, voters sent a clear message to globalists that they're extremely unhappy with the current situation in Europe, sending a wave of Eurosceptic, nationalist, and conservative representatives to Brussels. And that was just Europe. Around the world, from France to India, Australia to the Philippines, regular folks are pushing back against globalism. They were sick of their jobs being exported, they are done with war, and they are tired of high taxes, austerity programs, and corrupt governments, all of which serve only to benefit the world's moneyed elites, who profit from violence, slave labor, and corruption at the expense of the man in the street." For more on this, check out the two complimentary articles by AFP writer John Friend and columnist Patrick J. Buchanan. The good news is, regular people are fighting back through bloodless coups, voting out their old, unresponsive, corrupt governments and replacing them with new, populist nationalist leaders, who put their own people first. America paved the way with the election of Donald Trump. It's a positive sign of things to come and brings hope that we can keep the country on the right track through the upcoming presidential election in 2020. Christopher J. Petherick, executive editor, and Tifabitum by legal watchdog judge issues rare legal smackdown of politically correct neo-Bolshevik agitators. By Donald Jeffries, a California U.S. district judge has awarded Judicial Watch $22,000 in legal fees emanating from a suit filed by an Antifa organizer. Yvette Falarca, a Berkeley middle school teacher, and two co-plaintiffs were ordered to pay Judicial Watch's attorney fees and litigation costs. The suit had attempted to stop Judicial Watch from obtaining information about Falarca's activities. Falarca holds a prominent position in the group By Any Means Necessary, which was founded by the Marxist Revolutionary Workers League. This outfit, in typical social justice warrior style, works feverishly to thwart speaking engagements they don't approve of. Falarca is still awaiting trial for a 2016 incident where she and two others were charged with several crimes, including felony assault, while inciting a riot in Sacramento. She also was arrested for battery and resisting arrest during a 2017 confrontation with members of Patriot Prayer. Falarca lost in the courts last year as well. In January 2018, a different judge ordered her to pay more than $11,000 in legal and court fees for her frivolous effort to obtain a restraining order against former head of the California Berkeley College Republicans Troy Worden. Worden had actually sued Falarca for $100,000 in damages, claiming he didn't feel safe or comfortable on campus and called Berkeley the place where America's conservative youth are daily under threat of violence, lacking the support of the university administration, police, or city. The free speech movement is dead, and the left has killed it. Berkeley is ironically still associated in the minds of many with noble protests and radicals fighting for the right to speak out against those in power. This is a huge victory for Judicial Watch against Antifa and the violent left, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton said. Ms. Flarka attacked Judicial Watch without basis and the court was right to reject her ploy to deny our right to know because we don't share her violent left views. The alternative right is fighting back legally against the aggressive authoritarianism of groups like Antifa and Black Lives Matter. In January 2018, four individuals who came to UC Berkeley to hear controversial conservative Milo Yiannopoulos lecture sued the city and the school for failing to protect them from violent leftists. In this case, we had four innocent people who were not doing anything to provoke anyone, said Bill Becker of the Freedom X law firm, an attorney representing the plaintiffs. The problem was created by the campus administration, the UC Police Department, and Berkeley Police Department not doing their job to protect the public. A judge would later dismiss another lawsuit from a woman who was pepper sprayed during the violent protest that resulted in the cancellation of Yiannopoulos's appearance. That suit was filed in late August 2017 by Larry Klayman and Freedom Watch against Antifa, in Northern California's U.S. District Court. Earlier, right-wing pundit Ann Coulter's speech was also canceled by the university after violent leftist protests. The Flarka case represents an extremely rare legal victory for reason and common sense. High-profile alt-right figure Mike Cernovich spoke frequently in 2017 about working with the FBI and hiring attorneys to launch lawsuits against Antifa, because the establishment left has lost its collective mind and clearly doesn't believe in free speech. If any of these lawsuits winds up in a courtroom presided over by a liberal judge, it will be virtually impossible to win. Last October, Bethany Sherman, owner of a marijuana testing lab in Eugene, or, filed a defamation lawsuit against anonymous anti-fascist activists who tied her to white nationalists. They even began derisively referring to her as the weed Nazi. One of the absurd allegations against Sherman leveled by Eugene Antifa involved her supplying swastika-shaped cookies to gatherings celebrating Adolf Hitler's birthday. As a story about this case on Oregon Live admitted, Antifa groups, of which there are now dozens in the U.S., routinely publicize personal information of those they deem threats to people in their communities, a practice called doxing. The left used to hold the right to privacy in great regard, but they appear to have abandoned every classical liberal tenet in a crusade to crush dissent and inflict their will upon others. Antifa and Black Lives Matter members have been caught on countless videos physically assaulting those they disagree with, especially open Donald Trump supporters. It has not been generally publicized that the name Antifa derives from a moniker used by the German Communist Party, as early as 1932. Much of the left today appears to believe that hitting and assaulting those who offend them is perfectly proper. The mem punch a Nazi in the face is popular with them, and they aren't picky about how they define Nazi. The legal system must act appropriately to preserve our civil liberties. Border wall plan in jeopardy, by John Friend. The mainstream media and some conservatives have blasted President Donald Trump for failing to live up to his campaign promise to build a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico. The problem is, Trump has tried on multiple occasions to move ahead with plans for the wall but has faced unprecedented opposition from Democrats, activists, and the judiciary. On May 24, U.S. District Judge Haywood Gilliam Jr. issued a ruling halting the Trump administration's plan to transfer roughly $1 billion from drug enforcement efforts handled by the Department of Defense to border barrier construction projects in both Arizona and Texas. Congress has refused to approve federal funding at the level requested by Trump for border security, including physical barriers, fences, and walls along the border designed to prevent illegal immigration. Some of the funds the Trump administration has diverted to border security will still be allowed to be transferred at the president's request, including about $600 million diverted from an asset forfeiture fund administered by the U.S. Treasury Department, to border security in the Rio Grande Valley, according to the Associated Press. The $1 billion was initially secured by the Trump administration following the president's declaration of a national emergency along the border, and was meant to be diverted to funding two high-priority construction projects in New Mexico and Yuma, Arizona. Trump took to Twitter to denounce the federal judge and demand an appeal. Another activist Obama-appointed judge has just ruled against us on a section of the southern wall that is already under construction, the president tweeted. His is a ruling against border security and in favor of crime, drugs, and human trafficking. In related news, border officials on the front lines dealing with the immigration crisis are discovering that increasing numbers of migrants attempting to enter the United States are doing so fraudulently, with fake paperwork, fake stories, and fake family connections. According to a recent report published by the Epoch Times, 48% of all family units interviewed by federal immigration investigators from mid-April to May 10 had either fraudulent documents or family claims. Immigration and customs officials have implemented rapid DNA testing in border sectors near El Paso, Texas and the Rio Grande Valley, and have discovered at least 30% of cases involve fraudulent family claims. Immigration officials have even discovered cases of adults traveling with babies and other children who are not even their biological offspring. Stay tuned. Trump flip-flops on immigration despite vowing to solve America's immigration crisis. He has done nothing. By Donald Jeffries. On no other issue is Donald Trump's rhetoric so markedly different from his record than on immigration. During his 2016 presidential campaign, Trump repeatedly blasted America's laughable immigration policy and vowed to strike boldly and quickly to solve the problem. On August 15, 2015, Trump declared, "The influx of foreign workers holds down salaries, keeps unemployment high, and makes it difficult for poor and working-class Americans." He then promised, when elected, he would solve America's immigration woes. 3 years later, however, little has been done as the crisis on the U.S. southern border worsens. While Trump loyalists maintain he can't get anything done due to the refusal of Democrats to curtail immigration in the slightest, there are actions he could have taken. Trump promised, on March 3, 2016, "I will end forever the use of the H-1B visa as a cheap labor program, and institute an absolute requirement to hire American workers for every visa and immigration program. No exceptions." Trump could have ended this program, which has devastated wages in industries like information technology, with a stroke of a pen. Now, he advocates finding a pathway for citizenship for these H-1B workers, tweeting in January, "H-1B, sick. Holders in the United States can rest assured that changes are soon coming which will bring both simplicity and certainty to your stay, including a potential path to citizenship. We want to encourage talented and highly skilled people to pursue career options in the U.S., reports broke in the same month that Trump's companies had increased foreign visa usage to a 10-year high. In March, while sitting next to Apple CEO Tim Cook, Trump announced that we need more legal immigration. This followed his State of the Union remarks, "I want people to come into our country, in the largest numbers ever, but they have to come in legally." This represented the fourth time that month that Trump had suggested increasing the levels of legal immigration. Trump's continuing flip-flops on what was a centerpiece issue of his presidential campaign has brought loud criticism from one-time supporters. In a speech shortly thereafter, before the Conservative Political Action Committee, Trump declared, "We need an immigration policy that's going to be great for our corporations and our great companies." This is clearly a betrayal of what immigration hawks hoped the Trump administration would be for, declared Mark Krikorian, executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates cutting legal immigration by more than half. Krikorian called Trump not even that different from a conventional Republican. "We need to remember all of the promises that candidate Trump made on immigration, which included, most importantly, putting Americans first." Numbers use of Vice President of Government Relations Rosemary Jenks told Breitbart News, "I would certainly hope that in order to keep his campaign promises that before even talking about expanding legal immigration, he would work with employers to recruit the 50 million working-age Americans who are outside the labor market." Lou Dobbs of Fox Business News angrily remarked that Mr. Trump would advance the interests of the global elite ahead of our citizens would be a tragic reversal on any day. The White House has simply lost its way. Dobbs was particularly irate that Trump would fawningly say, in the presence of Cook and other corporate seekers of cheap labor, we want to have the companies grow, and the only way they were going to grow is if we give them the workers. All this completely contradicts Trump's campaign rhetoric, when he vowed to dramatically reduce the levels of legal immigration. In February of this year, Trump inexplicably folded and signed a spending bill that included a diabolical provision that effectively prevents the deportation of any illegal immigrant who can claim to be associated with a minor. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, agents have begun criticizing Trump's policy of dumping those arrested at the border right back onto American streets, while bragging about the number of arrests. They probably won't find a sympathetic ear at the top of their own organization. Trump recently named Mark Morgan, Barack Obama's Border Patrol chief, to head ICE. I know without a doubt that President Trump is a liar. He is deceptive, and intentionally manipulating his supporters to lead them to their own doom through amnesty for millions of illegal aliens, said William Gein, president of Americans for Legal Immigration. In truth, Trump shares Obama's tactics and immigration positions. More recently, Trump proudly introduced a new immigration plan, which was written by his liberal, globalist son-in-law Jared Kushner. The point man for his plan was lifelong open borders advocate and former never-Trumper Senator Lindsey Graham, RSC. The proposal, not surprisingly, doesn't address the core issue of illegal immigration at all. Trump even has developed a nonsensical plan to have ICE fly migrants and illegal aliens across the country, delivering them to shelters instead of deporting them back to their countries of origin. Trump has been all bark and no bite on immigration. Israel caught election meddling. Facebook bans lobbying firm for posting fake news to disrupt elections, by John Friend. A mysterious Israeli-based political consulting and lobbying firm was recently banned from Facebook for spreading fake news and disinformation designed to interfere with and disrupt elections in various countries around the world. According to Nathaniel Gleicher, head of cybersecurity policy for Facebook, 65 Israeli accounts, 161 pages, dozens of groups, and 4 Instagram accounts were recently purged by the social media giant, which has come under increasing scrutiny in recent years. In the aftermath of the purge, Facebook explained that the individuals associated with the banned accounts were tied to our committee's group, a Tel Aviv-based tech startup whose reported CEO, Elinadav Haiman, previously served as a spokesman and advisor in the Knesset, the unicameral legislative body in Israel. Haiman was also a senior intelligence agent in the Israeli Air Force and had worked as the director of the pro-Israel lobbying group European Friends of Israel, a major player in Brussels and the European Union political scene. The R Committee's group's official website appears to have been taken offline in the wake of the scandal, and individuals associated with the mysterious firm have refused to answer questions from the media. Prior to Facebook identifying the group as engaging in election interference and spreading disinformation, the firm's website boasted that it had played significant roles in many political campaigns, among them presidential campaigns and other social media projects all over the world, and that the organization specializes in using every advantage available in order to change reality according to our clients' wishes. The Times of Israel reported recently, Gleicher accused the R Committee's group of leading a campaign of coordinated inauthentic behavior designed to target Facebook users in a number of countries, including in sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia. The people behind this network use groups of fake accounts to run pages, disseminate content, and to act to artificially increase engagement and make the content more popular than it was, Gleicher stated. According to Facebook officials, the Archimedes group spent roughly $800,000 on fake Facebook ads going back to 2012. The ads were paid for using Brazilian reals, Israeli shekels, and US dollars over the years, with the most recent ad purchase having occurred last month. Our team assessed that because this group is primarily organized to conduct deceptive behavior, We are removing them from the platform and blocking them from coming back, Glieker announced. Many Israelis assigned to intelligence units during their mandatory military service leave the military with specialized knowledge and skills, including the use of avatars or fake identities on social media influencing campaigns, and other tech skills. Once in the private sector, there are countless Israeli-based technology firms that specialize in online marketing, social media campaigns, and other online services, many with duplicitous motives such as spreading disinformation and manipulating foreign elections. IDF intelligence likes to use avatars, an unnamed source inside the Israeli government explained to the Times of Israel. They use them against Israel's greatest enemies and they're extremely effective. The problem is that you have all these young people who served in the 8,200 intelligence unit and who know how to create fake profiles, and when they leave the army some of them say, I want to make money, and they sell their skills to whoever will pay them. Israeli activity on the dark web. In related news, the FBI announced that just prior to Facebook purging the Israeli-based company for social media manipulation and spreading disinformation, yet another Israeli team involved in setting up and operating an illegal online marketplace on the so-called darknet had been arrested. Two Israelis were arrested at the beginning of this month on charges of money laundering conspiracy, the AP reported. A grand jury in Pittsburgh indicted the two Israelis, who were eventually arrested, one in France and the other in Israel. The team apparently made over $15 million in their illegal scheme, which involved operating an online marketplace known as Deep.Web. Deep.Web reportedly provided users with access to marketplaces where vendors sold everything from illegal narcotics such as fentanyl, heroin, and crystal methamphetamine, to assault rifles, malicious software, hacking tools and stolen financial information, according to the AP report. Many advanced Israeli technology firms and startups are organized, managed, and funded by individuals who formerly served in the Israeli military or intelligence agencies, and who many times have deep connections to the military and political establishment in the Jewish state. The Mossad, Israel's primary intelligence agency, even has a technology innovation fund called Libertov, which invests in startups, technology companies, and other private sector businesses in order to facilitate economic growth and innovation, particularly in businesses that are of strategic importance to the Israeli state and intelligence community. Libertov announced recently that it was actively seeking out investment opportunities from a wider variety of technology firms than it has previously, and has encouraged Israeli startups and other firms to apply for funding. We have decided to expand the fund's scope and open it to a wide range of technologies, Libertov CEO recently stated. Over the past 2 years, we have received many applications. Each of the companies was examined, focusing on their innovative technology, the quality of their team, and the potential from the investment. We made several strategic and high-quality investments and have already seen the benefits they bring to the Mossad. We now call on additional companies and entrepreneurs to approach us. We will be happy to work with the right entrepreneurs. Libertov aims to invest in companies specializing in a variety of fields, including financial technology, automation, 3D scanning and printing, AI, machine learning, online privacy, smart city technologies, and many other areas related to high tech. Climate sea illusion. U.S. Climate Agency admits that scientist was right. Air temperature monitoring stations provide faulty data. By St. Patrick, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has now admitted that poorly placed air temperature monitoring stations have artificially boosted global warming data. A large portion of the surface air monitoring stations had been set up in areas that have become more urbanized, thus more impacted by concrete, asphalt, and other materials that absorb heat during the day and release it at night. Anthony Watts of the What's Up With That website has long argued that the temperature readings were being falsely, if not purposefully, influenced by bad positioning of testing equipment. Watts specifically pointed to monitors such as one located in a concrete parking lot at the University of Arizona. The monitor is constantly surrounded by idling automobiles and concrete interacting with the Arizona sun. In 2012, NOAA took Watts's critique seriously and began a study of its own devices and their placement. Its recently released findings did, indeed, explain that decisions regarding monitor placement impacted results in ways that showed a marked increase in global warming. Until this point, Watts, who runs what is self-described as the world's most viewed site on global warming and climate change, has been labeled as a Koch-funded science denier by those who advocate the quickening, a massive increase in the rapidity of global warming and climate change consequences. Now that NOAA has vindicated Watts and his theory of visible heat sinks, places that store heat near monitoring stations causing them to record faulty readings, the inevitable backlash from the establishment science community will come. It always does. The debate over global warming, or climate change, remains so heated that even the debate's name is still a point of contention. Whatever the real state of the environment may be, both sides tend to stand in the kiddie pools of honest debate as they outdo each other in an effort to win or protect their sponsoring organization, program, or ideology. If anything is to be done about the real environmental problems, however, common facts need to be agreed upon and debates should be civilized. Hunters and fishermen are the country's most responsible conservationists. They do recognize that changes are taking place, that, at the very least, our greatest natural environments are being impacted by an overabundance of trash and waste. Yet a majority of problems seen by those who spend the most time in the environment are ones that can be largely eradicated by awareness, education, and personal and corporate responsibility. Scientists who vastly overreach on climate control often have endowments, grants, and positions of influence to protect. Environmental doom is the lifeblood of their lofty academic careers. Like kings of their realms, it's easy to make demands from ivory towers, mandatory purchases of carbon credits to offset personal energy use, increased taxation on fossil fuels, fertilizing the oceans, species relocation, banning bottled water, and many more. The realities of each monumental program are higher taxation and higher fees for the use of energy. What the conservationists know is that there are environmental problems to be acknowledged and resolved. The new findings from NOAA prove that mistakes can be made well before the numbers are gathered or analyzed. No one won this debate. No one has the upper hand. The environment is still in the shape it was before the findings were released. America's worsening ecological condition can be improved, and it doesn't need to necessarily happen through burdening taxation of Green New Deals. Both sides should respectfully accept the things that are tangible. Then the public debate over what remains theoretical can commence, without mocking and without demands. The 1960s guaranteed us that we would all be wearing oxygen masks by the new millennium. In the 1970s, predictions were for an imminent ice age. The ozone hole of the 1980s was going to make the sun toxic. Earth warmed in the 1990s, and we have experienced climate change since the 2000s. The issues, understated, over-exaggerated, or indifferent, continue to evolve. Will the attitudes and motivations that surround the debate on both sides evolve with them? Congress fiddles while Iran war looms. Democrat-controlled House needs to step in and stop neocon warmongering. By Dr. Ron Paul. Congress, and particularly the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives, seems determined to see the end of the Trump administration before the 2020 vote. Although House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, D-Calif, claims she is not seeking impeachment, she's accusing the president of covering up something. However, she won't say what until she can do more investigating. But Trump's opponents on both sides of the congressional aisle don't seem so enthusiastic about challenging the president when he actually does abuse his constitutional authority to pursue a more aggressive policy overseas. Late last week, for example, President Donald Trump declared a national security emergency brought about by unspecified Iranian malign activity, a loophole allowing him to bypass congressional review of some $8 billion in U.S. weapons to be sold to Saudi Arabia. Congress had been reluctant to approve yet more arms sales to Saudi Arabia after the president vetoed a bipartisan House and Senate approved bill requiring the U.S. to end its military support for the Saudi war of aggression against Yemen. What might this new Iran emergency be? As with the lead-up to the Iraq War, the administration claims important secret intelligence, but, of course, we have to just trust them. From what we have heard from the administration, it looks pretty flimsy. Rear ADM, Michael Gilday, the director of the Joint Staff, has outright claimed that the so-called sabotage of four container ships at port in the UAE is the doing of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. But even Abu Dhabi didn't claim Iranian involvement in the mysterious incident. Could it have been a false flag? Gilday also claims, without providing proof, that the recent firing of a small rocket in the general vicinity of the U.S. Embassy in Iraq is the work of the Iranians. We believe with a high degree of confidence that this recent attack stems back to the leadership in Iran at the highest levels, he said. What would Iran gain by shooting off an insignificant rocket, exposing itself to U.S. massive retaliation with no gain whatsoever? They don't say. The Trump administration has been lacking any coherent foreign policy strategy for some time. It often seems the president is fighting more with his own appointees than with his opponents on Capitol Hill. As soon as he announces that ISIS is defeated and U.S. troops must come home, his employees, like National Security Advisor John Bolton, clarify Trump's statements to mean that troops are staying. Trump goes to Hanoi to cut a deal with North Korea's Kim Jong-un and Bolton shows up with a poison pill that blows up the whole deal. Bolton announced plans for 120,000 U.S. troops to be sent to the Middle East to help push the war on Iran he's been hawking for 20 or so years. Then we heard it was 10,000, then 1,500, of which 600 are already there. Whether or not Trump is on board, his administration is clearly dragging the U.S. into conflict with Iran. While some members remind the president that he does not constitutional authority to attack Iran without approval, that argument has not been very effective in deterring presidents thus far. If Congress really wanted to rein in an out-of-control president, they have plenty of opportunity in his bogus national emergency declaration and his saber-rattling toward Iran. But if asserting constitutional authority means Congress acts to pull back U.S. militarism overseas, suddenly there is a great bipartisan silence. They'd rather impeach Trump over his rude tweets than over his stomping on the Constitution. Universal basic income, Alaska, Kenya, Finland have tried it with mixed results. By St. Patrick before attributing the idea of a universal basic income, UBI, to Justice Democrats. Hanging off the left wing of American politics by a single daisy, consider that Alaska, a state that has only voted for one Democrat for president in its entire history, LBJ in 1964, has since 1976 given its residents a very popular version of the UBI. UBI, often called a basic income guarantee, is a periodic cash payment delivered to all citizens of a region or country who qualify as residents. In most situations, Aruba payment is unconditional, other than variations determined by the recipient's age. It is an automatic payment made at a set date, for example, weekly, monthly, annually, and is neither determined nor adjusted by an increase or decrease in the recipient's earnings elsewhere. It is paid to an individual and not to a couple or household. It is a right, where enacted, of an individual who meets residency requirements. The payment made to Alaskan residents comes from the Alaska Permanent Fund, set up in 1976 to disperse money taken in from the state's massive oil revenues. At the end of 2016, the fund was worth $55 billion. The amount given to Alaskans changes by year in accordance with the fund's performance. At its peak, residents received $2,072 in 2015. In 2008, Governor Sarah Palin, R., signed a bill whereby Alaskans received an additional one-time payment of $1,200. The idea behind Alaska's annual payout is the communal ownership of natural resources. When the state and private companies have done so well mining Alaska's natural resources, the people of the state should also share in those profits. Despite the popularity of the permanent fund dividend in an overwhelmingly Republican Alaska, skeptics are critical as to the feasibility of any UBI plan scaling upward to cover an entire population. GiveDirectly, a Google-led charity, experimentally funded selected villages in Kenya for fixed amounts of time. There were positive results that could be gleaned. Yet questions arose as to how the villages were chosen, how payments were made, to whom payments were made, and over what period of time they could be made. Finland's government, over one calendar year in 2017 and 2018, funded 2,000 unemployed residents at a cost of approximately $600 per individual per month. Finnish politicians balked at expanding the program further. A large-scale UBA would certainly mean expanding annual costs. As the UBA increases, representing a larger portion of a country's GDP, there is concern that there would be less funds available for infrastructure and services to further help those lives the UBA system would seek to improve. Andrew Yang is a Democrat running for president in 2020. On his campaign website, Yang writes, "As president, my first priority will be to implement universal basic income for every American adult over the age of 18, $1,000 a month, no strings attached, paid for by a new tax on the companies benefiting most from automation." Yang says he is running for president out of fear for his country. New technologies, robots, software, artificial intelligence, have already destroyed more than 4 million U.S. jobs, and in the next 5-10 years, they will eliminate millions more. A third of all American workers are at risk of permanent unemployment, and this time, the jobs will not come back. A newly released report by the New Economics Foundation concluded that funds would be better spent on reforming social protection systems and building more and better quality public services, education, health care, transportation, public housing, and social services are cited as examples of social systems that could be improved rather than dishing out direct payments to consumers. The argument for services over payments hinges on the destination of the funds. Those hoping to improve social services for residents resent the idea that direct payments would wind up back in the coffers of those businesses that have put millions of Americans out of work in the first place. Advocates of direct payments believe residents should share in a part of the profits when a nation's natural resources have been sold both globally and profitably. This is a much more complex idea than just being a handout to people with a limited motivation to work. UBA is also not a replacement for a career, savings, or responsible financial decision-making. What UBA could do, however, is balance out the profits of those companies and governments that have pillaged the natural resources and then expected the people to remain beholden to those importing the same resources. For example, Americans and oil, whether scaling such a program beyond Alaska's 737,438 residents is possible is a debate Americans will certainly need to engage in as technology continues to limit the possibilities of permanent employment. The Absurdity of Virtue Signaling, by Donald Jeffries in late May, stories broke all over the mainstream media, asking breathlessly whether weddings are too white. Evidently, a Hira for obscure Nigerian-born British woman, Assumpta Vikku, was looking through some wedding magazines, in preparation for her upcoming wedding. As her white Romanian fiancé scrutinized the photos in the magazines, he became alarmed that there were no black faces. Vikku became more infuriated after she went to a wedding show that featured hundreds of firms marketing their products and services, and felt almost invisible. She claimed to have stood at one stand while a jeweler waited on a previous customer. "He didn't acknowledge me once," she complained. Then two Caucasian women walked over and he immediately said, "Please give me a moment and I'll be right with you." Such is the predictable world of identity politics. Many questions arise about this particular story. First, how did this previously unknown Nigerian immigrant attract the interest of the biggest mainstream media outlets in the UK, including the BBC? To no one's surprise, the wedding industry instantly genuflected before Vikku, with an editor for huge online wedding site Confetti issuing the standard apology. "There's been a long overdue awakening," Zoe Burke explained. "For a long time there's been a growing consciousness that the industry as a whole hasn't been reflective of the society that we live in." What followed was a brief explosion from the usual suspects, with further allegations of various discriminations against black brides and ridiculous statements about there being a bizarre silence surrounding them. One black woman, Nova Reed, blasted wedding shows that hand out tanning products, exclaiming, "It was as if these shows were not expecting black women to be coming through the door." Not expecting us to be getting married, it is impossible to spoof the virtue signaling left at this point. The term virtue signaling refers to actions taken or statements made intended to signal to others one's moral correctness or virtue. In recent years, charges of racism have been leveled at bandages and brown paper bags. A few years ago, ESPN actually fired an Asian announcer because someone complained about his birth name, Robert Lee. The BBC stopped using the terms BC, before Christ, and AD, Anno Domini, meaning in the year of our Lord. Years ago, a school in Seattle renamed offensive Easter eggs as Spring Spheres. As far back as 2016, American school systems began instructing their teachers to cease using the terms boy and girl to describe their students. This has been increasingly happening not only in the United States, but in countries all over the Western world. In 2014, a feminist campaign began getting traction in the mainstream media, whereby it was claimed that the term bossy was an unacceptable slur against little girls. Celebrated females such as Condoleezza Rice, Beyoncé, Jennifer Garner, and the Girl Scouts organization jumped on this bandwagon. Once the term hate speech was introduced into our lexicon by the establishment, it was inevitable that free speech would be endangered. Indeed, just one of the putrid byproducts of the Patriot Act was the creation of free speech zones, which permit befuddled Americans to be ushered into an enclosed area where they can express their increasingly restricted right to free expression. Most Americans don't realize that the term politically correct was originally used in recurring sketches on Saturday Night Live back in the 1990s, which starred the late Phil Hartman. What was once fodder for absurdist comedy has now become the backbone of our increasingly distasteful culture. It was bad enough that many blacks, when a dog barks at them, have suggested that the white owner somehow instilled racism in them. Now, one Ben Falding, of the Washington Post, has taken the next step and simply declared that dogs themselves are racist. Falding utilized his best social warrior lingo by concluding man's best friend is a tool of white supremacy and gentrification. Falding went on to explain, "That's not just my opinion. There is research that shows how white newcomers' dog walking routes stake out territory, and white owners use their pets to socialize with other white owners excluding minorities." Someone replied to this on Twitter with a reference to students at Black Washington, D.C. Howard University feeling disrespected by whites cutting through the campus while walking their dogs. Alicia Sanchez Gill, of Safe Spaces D.C., tweeted, "White folks, I don't care how nice your dog is, dogs have been used as a tool of white control, dominance and violence, from slavery, through civil rights to police dogs today, even 10 years ago. Such virtue signaling terms as body shaming and gender neutral would have been scoffed at by most Americans. It is now being seriously claimed that biological men can give birth. Identity politics is incompatible with a free society. Someone has to have the courage to point out the emperor is wearing no clothes." Bilderberg boy blames Trump was former governor. John Hickenlooper indoctrinated at last Bilderberg meeting. Bilderberg graduate recently told prominent Chicago globalists about his foreign policy and outlined his NWO-centered presidential candidacy. By Mark Anderson, former Colorado governor, John Hickenlooper appears to be a changed man ever since he fraternized in Turin, Italy with some of the world's most influential transnationalists at the secretive Bilderberg meeting last year. Having cast aside comparatively mundane local and state issues, the 2020 Democratic presidential aspirant has morphed into a foreign policy expert and is going global all the way, Bilderberg style. On May 20, Hickenlooper became the first 2020 presidential candidate to address the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, CCGA, in Chicago. CCGA originated in 1922 as the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. The group has welcomed several regular and semi-regular Bilderberg attendees over the years, though few who have sought the White House. Hickenlooper's message was clear: President Donald Trump is a menace not just to the U.S. but to all that is global, largely because, according to Hickenlooper, Trump's rhetoric and actions divide the American people from within and drive a wedge between the U.S. and its allies in terms of the big picture. In the world of Hickenlooper and his CCGA confreres, Trump's intransigence couldn't possibly be a simple opposition to a rigged globalist system that nearly always gets its way and keeps centralizing wealth and power into fewer and fewer hands. It couldn't be that Trump won the White House because most people agree that globalism's days should be numbered and a return to principled nationhood could be the answer. Nor could the nation's divisive climate be the result of a media-fed frenzy trying to second-guess and upset Trump's efforts at every turn. Oh, no. It could only be that Trump is bad and that Hickenlooper, the assembled CCGA globalists, and their fellow travelers know what's good for everyone, the glaring failures of forced, clandestine globalization notwithstanding. Hickenlooper made several boilerplate points, typical of those who've experienced the Bilderberg immersion, including that he'd rejoined the Paris Agreement on my first day in office to counter Trump's move, on the eve of the 2017 Bilderberg meeting in Virginia, to withdraw the U.S. from the nebulous climate change pact, while Hickenlooper's most salient point was that the U.S. needs cyber walls to protect its vulnerable computer-intensive mass transit, communications, financial, defense and energy systems. He contrasted that with Trump's effort toward creating an effective border wall, tactical infrastructure system, in an arguably unfair manner. Trump obsesses about border walls, Hickenlooper lamented, while avoiding the more objective view of seeing both kinds of walls as important, especially with tens of thousands of people a day, many with unknown backgrounds, now being apprehended at the southern border, largely in Texas. While Hickenlooper voiced the tiresome trope that Russia invaded the 2016 election, implying, like most good globalists, that Trump would have lost the election to Hillary Clinton if it wasn't for those rogue Russians, he trounced Trump for enacting tariffs against Chinese goods, but he did so without taking into account that America's long-term trade deficit with China, to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars per year, has caused a huge forfeiture of U.S. wealth to China, enabling the communist base nation to leverage its surplus from such a gravely imbalanced trade to vastly bolster its military and cyber spying capabilities. Hickenlooper even went so far as to say that Trump launched tariff wars and is hostile toward trade itself when 95% of consumers of U.S. production, he said, live outside U.S. borders. Trump has so far mainly reoriented trade, in an apparent effort, though the jury is still out in some areas, to make it fair and more balanced, partly to avoid what happened with trade with China, which was set up by veteran Bilderbergers, the late David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger, but Trump's trade efforts also appear to be geared to give American producers a boost and, to a degree, increase overall job creation and spending power. Hickenlooper appears tone-deaf to such details and instead dutifully spouts the one-world line pretty much across the board. If elected, he also would adhere to UN mandates and initiatives with few if any exceptions, rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership mega-trade pact that Trump left in early 2017 to influence China, and never pull U.S. troops out of Syria or anywhere else without consulting all available in-house policy experts, implying that Trump's more autonomous approach to reduce troop levels is wrong-headed. Hickenlooper added that NATO demonstrates all that is right about the New World Order, claiming that Trump's basic approach to make more of NATO's members pay a fair share of operating costs is somehow ill-advised when, in fact, Trump, as is the case with tariffs on Chinese imports, has fought for better equity for America regarding NATO and other global arrangements. All told, Hickenlooper seems to have been cured of any nationalist notions that he may have harbored in days gone by, as might be expected from a recent Bilderberg graduate, former NFL player tackling NWO Christian convert, now a pastor, says International Banker's The Real Enemy, by Dave Gahiri. Kenneth B. Klein is not your typical author trying to alert readers to the dangers of the New World Order. Throughout his life, Klein has blazed his own path by, among other things, playing professional football, making films, and becoming a preacher. Despite being born into a Jewish family, Klein explained to this reporter, "I've always believed in Jesus from the time I was born. I had a deep reverence for Jesus." Talented on the gridiron, Klein was drawn to professional sports. "I ended up playing for the University of Oregon for 3 years," he explained. Then I got picked up by the San Francisco 49ers and then the Houston Oilers, but got devastated by injuries. It brought a quick end to my career in the pros, and then I went on a long period of darkness where I didn't really know who I was or what I wanted to do. That's when I was intercepted by God and became a follower of Jesus and have been for 50 years now. During that time, Klein's been busy. I've pastored 3 churches, produced about 20 documentary films, written about 4 or 5 books, he said. This new book, he continued, is kind of the last work I've done, The Deep State Prophecy and The Last Trump, and then I have a film coming out shortly, The Four Horsemen of the End Game. Klein believes that today's events are signs that we are in the end times. What we're seeing play out before our very eyes every day is a collision, he explained. The great divide today in our political system, between the conservatives and the liberals, 2 worldviews. One worldview is what George H.W. Bush said, that we're gonna have a new world order whether we want it or not. The other, he believes, is championed by President Donald Trump. The new world order is conflicting with our president's view of a nation-state system, he said. The culprit to this divide, the House of Rothschild and the Federal Reserve Act. This goes all the way back to the British banking houses in London, he explained, and that's what this book's all about. Although today's fake news media and publishing houses nary make mention of the Rothschilds, Klein's certain they were still pulling the strings, but from behind the curtain. They went rogue by going invisible and erased themselves and redacted themselves from British history, he explained. The reason they did was, because their imperialism was so tyrannical. They conquered China through opium and they conquered India by getting slave labor so they could get cotton into their control of the textile industry in the 1800s, and they became so infamous that they had to disband, or at least have the appearance that they disbanded. Klein explained how the Rothschilds maintain control today. What they did about 20 years ago is, he explained, they allowed Lloyd's of London to control and dictate the price of gold and silver, which is the de facto measurement for every currency in the world, and they don't have to be seen. That's their proxies. Klein detailed an enemy of this nation painfully familiar to this newspaper's readers. In my book, I deal with these 2 beasts. One beast is this system of empires that started with the Egyptian Empire all the way through the British Empire to the present-day New World Order in Manhattan, which is characterized by the United Nations. And the second beast, which is called a false prophet, I believe is international media control, he explained. When you talk about media control and the ability for them to manage the information that we get, one of the things they are doing and trying to do is to eliminate free speech and the ability to communicate with one another. So right now, for example, in Facebook they control who gets your messages. They also control it for YouTube. These are the same people that control all this information. The ability to stop us from communicating would eliminate the possibility for organizing to deal with it. So it's becoming harder and harder to communicate in a way that people can be organized to deal with the problems in a groundswell against the evil. They know what they were doing. They are powerful people that are brilliant. That's why I say our time is short. President Trump has maybe 5-1/2 years left, Klein continued. What happens when he's gone? There isn't anybody like him. So we don't have a long time to be able to prepare for the negativity in the outside world that can control us. And the only way to deal with it is not where we can organize to overthrow the wickedness in the Congress, or these people that are speaking against our own president, but to be able to just stand and not let it overcome us. People need to be fortified on the inner man so that they are not overcome by this outside world, because the outside world is overcoming a lot of people, explained Klein. A lot of Christians are falling. I have a friend that's a pastor, and he's speaking against Trump. And I'm going, would you rather have Nancy Pelosi, are you crazy, or Hillary Clinton, or any of these other people? They're incredibly insane, and yet they come off as very normal. Klein believes there's hope. I think President Trump has been sent by the Lord to give us more time to gather more people for the kingdom of God that we're called to, Klein said. This man's been put in this place as a godsend, I believe, and he's been equipped with special abilities to deal with all of these things. So the kingdom of God surrounds this guy, and that means there's angelic powers that accompany him so that he can do this. It's supernatural, him being able to stand in this intense scrutiny and pressure and evil. This poor man, what he's gotta endure, it's unbelievable, said Klein. I don't know if anybody's ever, other than Jesus maybe, been affected by so much hatred. It's unbelievable. Drone technology, a threat to all pilotless, remote-controlled drones are being flown by terrorists, drug cartels, by Richard Walker when remote-controlled flying drones closed London's Gatwick Airport in 2018. It was a clear warning that a new threat era had emerged, requiring urgent action. It was, in fact, a threat that had been developing for more than a decade, with signs as far back as 2010 that over-the-counter drones would become available and that their fast, changing capabilities would outstrip efforts to counter them unless there was a major plan by governments to invest heavily in anti-drone technologies. Today, the threat is not only confined to kids or terrorists flying drones into airspace over airports. Drug cartels no longer need to build tunnels under the southern border to flood the U.S. with cocaine and methamphetamines. Using drone technology, they can now deposit drugs outside population centers many miles from the border, just as Amazon plans to deliver packages via drones. In the near future, as Amazon and other companies begin using drones to deliver their goods, who is going to police the drone flying over your house to make sure it is from Amazon and not a Mexican cartel? Terrorists or foreign spies can now be virtually placed close to critical infrastructure that they may wish to evaluate for a future attack by deploying drones equipped with night vision sensors over, for instance, power plants. Foreign agents can use drones to mount a hack of a critical government facility. If you are not scared by the prospect of any of this happening, consider for a moment what terrorists will soon be able to achieve with this new technology. They will be able to bring down commercial planes or deliver bombs or small radiological devices. When you consider how patient and inventive terrorists have been in the past, especially members of Al-Qaeda, you can be certain they are studying closely the singular advantages of drones. ISIS is known to have experimented with drones to deliver bombs in the wars in Iraq and Syria. If the attack on Gatwick Airport taught us anything, it was just how vulnerable we are to the use of drones for malicious purposes. The British police and the best technical minds in MI5 learned that tracking drones and tracing them to a source is almost impossible in real time. They discovered that those flying the drones did not have to be stationary. They could be constantly on the move, operating from cars or vans. Authorities never found the perpetrators of the Gatwick Airport attack, and theories abound that it was intended to test the vulnerability of a major British airport or a drier run by people with a longer-term agenda to create damage or havoc at a major transit hub. An MI5 security expert, who wished to remain anonymous, agreed to talk to AFP off the record about the nature of the threat. People think of drones in terms of America's secret drone war, forgetting that drone technology is now readily available. The truth is, we are limited in the countermeasures we need to combat just basic malicious threats at airports and in heavily populated towns and cities. By the time you identify a malicious drone attack by tracing the electronic signature, the way you would a phone signal bouncing off a cell tower, it is often too late because the drone operator has shifted to another location. At Gatwick, we had to bring in a lot of technical gear, and that made the whole exercise cumbersome, losing us time. Unless you have the best tracking gear in place at airports, there is going to be a disaster, and that is not even taking into account what terrorists made by sending a small drone swarm at a target. We have not been taking these threats seriously enough, and it means we did not have the edge we should have. On July 4, 2017, little notice was paid when a drone dropped tools into a correctional facility in Texas, enabling a prisoner to escape. The good news is, unlike the Obama administration, the Trump White House has now provided major financial resources to deal with this threat to the homeland. Time is not necessarily on our side, however. By 2010, over 50 nations were developing drone technology. The Chinese in particular, seeing how lucrative it could be, were anxious to flood the international market with personal drones. In a 2011 study for the Brookings Institute, John Villasenor, a professor of electrical engineering, law, public policy, and management at UCLA, sounded the alarm for Congress to act. Today we have the luxury of assuming that the sky above us is free of nearly invisible pilotless aircraft under the control of a hostile group and possibly carrying a payload that might do us harm. Continued advances in drone technology make it all but certain that in future years we will no longer have that luxury. If the tragedy of 9/11 proved anything, it was that our adversaries can be inventive as well as ruthless, and drones provide them with a new and potentially lethal tool. Internet free speech all but dead unelected, unnamed censors operating across internet to suppress unapproved content. By Philip Giraldi, the internet was originally promoted as a completely free and uncensored mechanism for people everywhere to exchange views and communicate, but it has been observed by many users that that is not really true anymore. Both governments and the service providers have developed a taste for controlling the product, with President Barack Obama once considering a kill switch that would turn off the internet completely in the event of a national emergency. President Donald Trump has also had a lot to say about fake news and is reported to be supporting limiting protections relating to the internet. In May, a net neutrality bill that would have prevented service providers from manipulating internet traffic passed in the House of Representatives, but it is reported to be dead on arrival in the Senate, so it will never be enacted. Social networking sites have voluntarily employed technical fixes that restrict some content and have also hired reviewers who look for objectionable material and remove it, pending European legislation. Meanwhile, might require internet search engines to eliminate access to many unacceptable old posts. YouTube has already been engaged in deleting existing old material and is working with bias partners like the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, to set up guidelines to restrict future content. Many users of Facebook will have already undoubtedly noted that some contacts have been blocked temporarily, or even permanently, and denied access to the site. Google now automatically disables or limits searches for material that it deems to be undesirable. If Google does not approve of something, it will either not appear in search results or it will be very low on the list. And what does come up will likely favor content that derives from those who pay Google to promote their products or services. Information that originates with competitors will either be very low in the search results or even blocked. Google is consequently hardly an unbiased source of information. In May 2017, Facebook announced that it would be hiring 3,000 new censors, and my own experience of social networking censorship soon followed. I had posted an article entitled Charlottesville Requiem that I had written for a website at the end of the first day. The site managers noticed that, while the article had clearly attracted a substantial Facebook readership, the likes for the piece were not showing up on the screen counter, that is, were not being tabulated. It was also impossible to share the piece on Facebook, as the button to do so had been removed. The likes on sites like Facebook, Yahoo, News Comments, YouTube, and Google are important because they automatically determine how the piece is distributed throughout the site. If there are a lot of likes, the piece goes to the top when a search is made or when someone opens the page. Articles similarly can be sent to Coventry if they receive a lot of dislikes or negative marks, so the approvals or disapprovals can be very important in determining what kind of audience is reached or what a search will reveal. In my case, after one day my page reverted to normal. The likes reappeared, and readers were again able to share the article, but it was clear that someone had been managing what I had posted, apparently because there had been disapproval of my content based on what must have been a political judgment. A couple of days later, I learned of another example of a similar incident. The Ron Paul Institute, RPI, website posts much of its material on YouTube, owned by Google, on a site where there had been advertising that kicked back to RPI a small percentage of the money earned. Suddenly, without explanation, both the ads and rebate were eliminated after a manual review determined the content to be unsuitable for all advertisers. This was a judgment rendered apparently to add a disapproval of what the institute does and says. The ability to comment on and link from the pieces was also turned off. Dissident British former diplomat Craig Murray also noted in April 2018 the secretive manipulation of his articles that are posted on Facebook, observing that his site's visitor numbers were currently around one-third normal levels, stuck at around 20,000 unique visitors per day. The cause was not hard to find. Normally over half of our visitors arrive via Facebook. These last few days, virtually nothing has come from Facebook. What is especially pernicious is that Facebook deliberately imposes this censorship in a secretive way. The primary mechanism when a block is imposed by Facebook is that my posts to Facebook are simply not sent into the timelines of the large majority of people who are friends or who follow. I am left to believe the post has been shared with them, but in fact it has only been shown to a tiny number. Then, if you are one of the few recipients and you see the post and share it, it will show to you on your timeline as shared, but in fact the vast majority of your own friends will also not receive it. Facebook is not doing what it is telling you it is doing. It shows you it is shared, and Facebook is deliberately concealing that fact from you. Twitter has a similar system known as shadow banning. Again, it is secretive and the victim is not informed. More recently, pressure to censor internet social networking and information sites has increased, coming both from government and from various interested constituencies. In late May, Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg met with French President Emmanuel Macron to discuss how to eliminate hate speech on the internet. The two men agreed that the United States internet model, in spite of already being heavily manipulated, is too laissez-faire, and expressed an interest in exploring the French system where it is considered acceptable to ban unacceptable points of view. Zuckerberg suggested that it might serve as a good model for the entire European Union. France is reportedly considering legislation that establishes a regulator with power to fine internet companies up to 4% of their global revenue, which can in some cases be an enormous sum, if they do not curb hateful expressions. So unelected, unnamed censors are operating all around the internet to control the content, which I suppose should surprise no one. And the interference will only get worse as both governments and service providers are willing to do what it takes to eliminate views that they find unacceptable, which, curiously enough, leads one to consider how it came about and the current hysteria being generated in the conventional media and also online against both Venezuela and Iran. How much of the anger is essentially fake, being manipulated or even fabricated by large companies that earn mega billions of dollars by offering under false pretenses a heavily managed product that largely does what the government wants. Banning hate speech will be, unfortunately, only the first step in eliminating any and all criticisms of the status quo. Book says Haig took down Nixon. Author details how Chief of Staff Alexander Haig orchestrated President's downfall. By S.T. Patrick and Haig's coup, how Richard Nixon's closest aide forced him from office. Ray Locher's newest work on the fall of Richard Nixon, we see exactly how Chief of Staff General Alexander Haig orchestrated Nixon's demise and resignation. It's easy to criticize Nixon for his handling of the Watergate affair, said Roger Stone, an aide to Nixon. But until one fully understands the roles of White House counsel John Dean and subsequent White House Chief of Staff Alexander Haig, one cannot fully understand why the Woodward and Bernstein narrative about Watergate is false. Locher, a former editor at USA Today, released Nixon's Gamble in 2016. In it, he set the stage for the eventual fall. President Richard Nixon took a risk in establishing a tight-knit foreign policy team that bypassed the Departments of State and Defense as well as the CIA, as per National Security Decision Memorandum 2. Signed by Nixon shortly after being sworn in as president, Nixon would be at the center of foreign policy, and he would be surrounded by a small team of loyal aides. Under Nixon's command, Vietnam and Cold War policy would be conducted through the National Security Council, NSC, and its National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. The new power structure was secret, unprecedented, and extra-constitutional. For Nixon, it was also a dangerous gamble that, on his first day as president, set into motion his precipitous fall. Nixon's restructuring jump-started a series of spying operations between the Defense Department and the White House. The Joint Chiefs were suspicious of Nixon's policies in Vietnam, détente with the Soviets, and opening up trade with China. In what is now called the Moore-Radford Affair, the Joint Chiefs, led by Chairman ADM, Thomas Moore, set about spying on the Kissinger team. U.S. Navy Yeoman Charles Radford was tasked with much of the spying and theft of documents that led to the outing of the spy ring in a Jack Anderson column in December 1971. Haig had been the link between the military and the White House, even before becoming chief of staff in May 1973. Haig was Kissinger's deputy at the NSC and received the secret communications from the military leadership at the Pentagon as well as from world leaders. In 1969 and 1970, the Navy lieutenant who manned the Pentagon's secret communications room was Bob Woodward. In that role, he was charged with briefing Haig at the White House. This was the impetus for Woodward's professional relationship with the general, a relationship that would pad the journalist's second bestseller. Woodward insisted to authors Len Kolodny and Robert Jetlin, Silent Coup, that he had never met Haig until 1973. Testimony from Moorer, Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, and Pentagon spokesman Jerry Friedheim proves otherwise. Woodward would go on to journalistic fame at the Washington Post, and Haig would remain the most consequential leaker in the Nixon White House. Haig consolidated power within the office of the Chief of Staff, a position he ascended to when H.R. Haldeman was forced to resign. He closed off access to the Oval Office and even chose Nixon's personal attorney. Nixon was somewhat justified in his paranoia. After Haldeman and John Ehrlichman left, there was no one remaining in the White House who had the president's best interests in mind. Rather, Haig was acting completely out of his own best interest and was hastening the president's downfall. It is Locker's contention, backed by his study of recently declassified documents, that Haig orchestrated Nixon's actions in the Saturday night massacre of October 1973 that saw the firing of Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. Haig lied to Nixon and Attorney General Elliot Richardson, informing the president that Richardson had agreed to fire Cox, when he had not. The massacre rid Haig of Cox, whom he saw as an enemy, but the backlash further damaged Nixon. Each of Haig's maneuvers was a calculated one in a further effort to conceal his own role as a leaker and primary participant in the spy ring. In doing so, other scapegoats were built to fall. Regarding Mark Felt as Deep Throat, Locker writes that much of the information that has since been attributed to Felt bore the unmistakable fingerprints of Alexander Haig. Watergate revisionists have long pointed to Haig as either the sole Deep Throat or as part of a composite Deep Throat character built by Woodward solely for narrative purposes. But Woodward protected Haig and, in fact, used him as the major source and hero of the second Woodward and Bernstein Watergate book, The Final Days. Locker's research also damns Haig regarding the White House taping system that was first publicly revealed by the testimony of Deputy Assistant Alexander Butterfield. Haig stated in his memoirs that he hadn't heard of the taping system until Butterfield revealed the information to America. The truth is that Nixon had told Haig of the system 2 months earlier, and Haig used the knowledge to orchestrate Butterfield's release to the Senate Watergate Committee. Locker also discusses Haig's involvement in selected erasures, and he once again proves that Haig lied about encouraging Nixon to destroy the tapes. At one point, upon overhearing a conversation between Nixon and Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield, Haig stated, "I run this White House, and don't you ever forget it." For a man who would, in 1981 as Secretary of State, infamously declare, "I'm in charge here," in the wake of the assassination attempt on President Reagan, Haig was following a pattern of rushing in when a power vacuum existed. He had brought down one president. He was going to be present and accounted for if another president fell as fatally as Nixon did politically. Lies about World War I abound. What we're being taught about war to end all wars basically allied propaganda. By Paul Craig Roberts, my generation associated dystopias, such as George Orwell's 1984, with the Soviet Union, a country in which explanations were controlled and criticism of Stalin would land a person in the gulag. We thought of the United States and our life here much differently, but with the passage of time the difference between life in the Soviet Union in the 20th century and life in the Western world today is disappearing. Today, the journalist Julian Assange is undergoing the same kind of state terror and torture as any Soviet dissident, if not worse. The Western media is as controlled as the Soviet media, with print, TV, and public radio serving as a propaganda ministry for government and the interest groups that control government. Social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, are systematically denying their platforms to those who express views not supportive of the ruling order and its agendas. It has turned out to be easy to get rid of the First Amendment guarantee of free speech, as the media have neither the ability nor the intention of exercising it. It was a mistake for my generation to associate Orwell's memory hole and falsified history only with fictional or real dystopias. Falsified history was all around us. We just didn't know enough to spot it. What living and learning has taught me is that history tends to always be falsified, and historians who insist on the truth suffer for it. It has been established that many of the ancient historians are unreliable, because they were court historians who sought material benefit by writing to please a ruler. In my time, many an historian has written for income from book sales by enthralling the public with tales of glorious victories over demonized enemies that justified all the sons, grandsons, brothers, fathers, uncles, husbands, friends, and cousins who were sacrificed for the sake of capitalist armaments profits. No publisher wanted a truthful account that no one would buy because of the stark portrayal of the pointlessness of the deaths of loved ones. Everyone, or almost so, wants to think that their loss was for a noble cause and was worth it. With few exceptions, English-speaking historians have put the blame for both world wars on Germany. This is false history. The first real historian of World War I, or what was called at the time the Great War or the World War, was Harry Elmer Barnes. Barnes was professor of historical sociology at Smith College and the William Baird Cutting Fellow in History at Columbia University. His book, The Genesis of the World War, was published in 1926 by Alfred A. Knopf in New York. Instead of covering up, as expected, the Allied crimes and treachery against Germany, Barnes told the truth. The German Kaiser, a relative of the British and Russian royal families, was known throughout the world as a peacemaker, praised by the New York Times for that role. It is a known and indisputable fact that the German government acted for peace until Germany, the last power to mobilize, had to mobilize or be overrun by Russia and France, who were allied with the British against Germany. Never before in history has the very last power to mobilize been blamed for starting a war, but facts never get in the way of court historians. The genesis of the war was the desire on the part of two of the Russian Tsar's ministers for Constantinople and the French president for territory, Alsace-Lorraine, lost to Germany in the 1870 Franco-Prussian War. These schemers used Austria's response to the assassination of the Austrian Archduke in Serbia, which they likely orchestrated, to declare war. As Germany was the protector of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, President Woodrow Wilson secured an armistice to the World War, which had senselessly destroyed millions of lives, by promising Germany that if she agreed to an armistice, there would be no territorial losses for Germany and no reparations. When Germany agreed to the armistice, it was Germany that occupied territories of the opposing camp. There were no foreign troops on German territory. As soon as Germany disengaged, the British put into effect a food blockade that forced starving Germans to submit to the exploitative Versailles Treaty that violated every promise that President Wilson had made. Some intelligent people, including the most famous economist of the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes, said that the Versailles Treaty, an exercise in cover-up for who caused the war, guaranteed a future war, and they, not the grasping corrupt establishment, were right. For his truth-telling efforts, Harry Elmer Barnes was declared by the court historians to be a German agent paid to write a false history. As Barnes's voice was greatly outnumbered, the history of the Great War remained, for most, falsified throughout the 20th century. Barnes was vindicated in 2014 when Christopher Clark at Cambridge University published The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914. Clark added to Barnes's evidence that the Great War resulted from a plot by two Russian government ministers and the president of France to steal coveted territory from Germany and Turkey. But 100 years after the war, who is around to care? All the people who died in the war, as well as their bereaved families who suffered from the plot of three evil men, are dead and gone. The consciousness of the world has already been distorted by a century of false history, a false history that set up Germany for blame again. This time for World War II, nationalists claim historic victories, by Patrick J. Buchanan. Hillary Clinton called them the deplorables, Barack Obama called them losers who cling to their Bibles, bigotries, and guns. To President Jean-Claude Juncker of the European Commission, they are these populist, nationalists, stupid nationalists in love with their own countries. Well, stupid they may be, and, yes, they do love their countries, but last week they gave Juncker a thrashing, as they shook up the West and the world. Elections in the world's largest electoral blocs, the 28-nation EU, and an India of 1.3 billion people, showed that the tide of nationalism continues to rise and spread across Europe and Asia. In India, the Hindu nationalist BJP party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi won a smashing victory. So strong was Modi's showing that he rushed to reassure non-Hindus, especially India's 200 million Muslims, that they remain equal citizens. But in India, the Hindu hour is at hand. Nigel Farage's Brexit party, formed just months ago, ran first in Britain with 31%. No other party came close. Labour won 14% and Prime Minister Theresa May's Tories ran fifth with 9%, a historic humiliation. In the French elections, Emmanuel Macron's party lost to the National Rally of Marine Le Pen, whom he had defeated 2-1 in the last presidential election. Matteo Salvini's populist nationalist league, with 34%, ran first in Italy in a showing that could lead to national elections that could make him prime minister. The nationalist Law and Justice Party in Poland and the populist Fidesz Party of Viktor Orban in Hungary were easily victorious. In Germany, however, the conservative socialist coalition of Angela Merkel bled support. Both the CDU and SPD lost strength in defeats that could shake the Berlin government. What do these elections tell us? If the conservatives wish to remain in power in parliament, they will have to leave the European Union and, if necessary, crash out without a divorce settlement with Brussels. The Tories cannot defy the will of their own majority on the most critical issue in 50 years, a nationalist demand to be free of Brussels, and still survive as Britain's first party. Whoever wins the Tory competition to succeed May will almost surely become the prime minister who leads Britain out of the EU. Nor is that such a tragedy. The first Brexit, after all, was in 1776. When the 13 colonies of North America severed all ties to the British Crown and set out alone on the path to independence, it did not turn out all that badly. Last week's election also saw major gains for the Green parties across Europe. Laser focused on climate change, these parties will be entering coalitions to provide centre-left and centre-right regimes the necessary votes to create parliamentary majorities. The environment is now likely to rival third world immigration as an issue in all elections in Europe. While nationalists and populists control a fourth of the seats in the EU Parliament, they are isolated. They may have the power to block or veto EU actions by Brussels, but they cannot impose their own agenda. Yet even larger lessons emerge from these two elections. Liberalism appears to be losing its appeal. A majority in the world's largest democracy, India, consciously used their democratic right to vote, to advance sectarian and nationalist ends. Why is liberalism fading away, and nationalism ascendant? The former is an idea that appeals to the intellect. The latter, rooted in love of family, faith, tribe, and nation, is of the heart. In its potency to motivate men, liberalism is to nationalism what Nirbir is to Bombay gin. To be a proud Pole, Hungarian, Italian, or Scotsman has a greater grip on men's love, loyalty, and allegiance than to be a citizen of Europe. Whoever speaks of Europe is wrong, said Bismarck. Europe is but a geographical expression, identity politics, people identifying themselves by their ethnicity, nationality, race, culture, and faith, appears to be the world's future. Even leftists are bowing to the new reality. Identity politics is exactly who we are and it's exactly how we won, says Stacey Abrams, the African-American Democrat who almost won the Georgia governor's race. By centering communities in Georgia, we increased voter participation, we brought new folks to the process. The Democratic Party is now a coalition easily identifiable by race, ethnicity, ideology and gender, African American, Hispanic, Asian, LGBTQ, feminist, and, fanatically, green. Our founding fathers believed we Americans were a new people, a separate, unique, identifiable people, a band of brothers, who had risked their lives and shed their blood. Liberals believe we are held together by abstract ideas and ideals, such as democracy, equality, and diversity. But did Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, Calhoun, Clay, Jackson, Sam Houston, Tyler, and Polk really believe in equality and diversity as they drove Indians, French, British, Spanish, and Mexicans out of this land to create a continent-wide nation of their own? Or was Manifest Destiny really all about us, and not them? The rise of the nationalists around the world, the deplorables are electing populists to power. By John Friend, nationalists and populists the world round made their voices heard loud and clear in recent elections in both Australia and the European Union, EU, riding the wave of populist sentiment and dissatisfaction with liberal elites pushing multiculturalism, open borders, and a radical green environmentalist agenda, dissatisfaction that was so well capitalized on by Donald Trump in the 2016 election. 2 weeks ago, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison stunned the elite political pundits and talking heads who had predicted his defeat for weeks by winning re-election. Morrison leads a coalition of national parties that maintained support in both the suburbs of Australia's major metropolitan areas as well as in the countryside. The recently re-elected Prime Minister has voiced his admiration and support for Trump in the past, and it was clear he tapped into the populist talking points and agenda that helped the celebrity businessman turned politician fare so well in the last U.S. presidential election. Tonight is about every single Australian who depends on their government to put them first, Morrison declared at his victory party in Sydney after the election results were in, and that is exactly what we are going to do. During the election campaign, Morrison championed populist economic issues, arguing for economic stability and support for the middle and working classes that have been negatively impacted by the harsh reality of economic globalization, stagnant wages, and an increasing pool of foreign workers, economic migrants, and so-called refugees hoping to find a safe haven in Western countries like Australia. On the campaign trail, Morrison advocated for lowering energy prices and cutting costs for home buyers, among other populist issues. Morrison thanked the quiet Australians, the average salt of those Australian working men and women who supported his political coalition. It has been those Australians who have worked hard every day. They have their dreams, they have their aspirations, to get a job, to get an apprenticeship, to start a business, to meet someone amazing, Morrison noted, to start a family, to buy a home, to work hard and provide the best you can for your kids, to save for your retirement. These are the quiet Australians who have won a great victory tonight. Leading up to the election, political analysts were virtually guaranteeing a left-wing Labour victory, with one commentator boldly declaring that the election was unlosable for the Australian Labour Party. The so-called quiet Australians, often derided and dismissed by the Liberal political and media elites in Australia, threw a major wrench in their election forecasting and cost a devastating blow to the cosmopolitan, globalist Liberal elite. The Labour candidates had run on a platform focusing on climate change and environmental issues, increase in government funding for social services, and ending tax cuts for the wealthy, issues that are increasingly not resonating with working and middle-class voters who are more concerned with economic stability, jobs, and the negative effects of globalism and open borders. The US, Britain and Australia, perhaps Canada too, may be in the midst of a populist uprising. David Winston, a Republican advisor and strategist, recently argued following the election, populism usually arrives when governmental leaders are not addressing the agenda the country at large wants. Winston continued, what these countries with different elections and different electoral systems in very different parts of the world all face is a working and middle class that understands the importance of climate change but doesn't understand elites who consistently make climate change a higher priority than jobs, wages, the cost of living, and health care. What all these voters, who upended the political status quo and defied expectations in recent elections, share is a strong and sincere belief that elites, and only elites, In their societies control their government and its agenda, and they believe these elites neither respect their views nor care about their problems. Meanwhile, European nationalists and populists also fared well in the recent European parliamentary elections, which wrapped up this past weekend. Eurosceptic parties and anti-establishment voices made considerable gains in the EU elections, ensuring a radical shake-up of the ruling governing coalitions in Brussels. Voter turnout throughout much of Europe was at its highest levels in 20 years, with voters in many major European nations, including Italy, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, largely rejecting the mainstream political parties that have ruled for so long. The election results made clear that the major political factions to be contended with are now the more anti-EU forces on the right and the environmentalists on the left, as both forces made significant gains while the mainstream center, right parties, EPP, and the socialists and democrats, S&D, each lost seats overall. In France, the political party of current French President Emmanuel Macron, a globalist with close ties to the international community, lost to Marine Le Pen's more right-wing political faction. In Italy, Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini, a leading populist in European politics and a major critic of mass third-world immigration into Italy and Europe more generally, made significant gains as his League party won roughly one-third of the country's vote, ensuring his party will become one of the largest parties and political blocs in the European Parliament. Nigel Farage, whose Brexit party made significant gains in its first ever electoral contest, was a big winner in elections held in the UK, demonstrating that the more right-wing, Eurosceptic faction of British politics is still a force to be reckoned with. Following the elections, Salvini reached out to Le Pen, Farage, and Hungary's nationalist leader Viktor Orban in an effort to form a coalition of nationalists and populists that could effectively work together to combat the nation wrecking policies of the globalist forces who have heretofore dominated the EU. Salvini and other European nationalists had campaigned together leading up to the election as well, with a major rally organized by Salvini and attended by Le Pen and other right-wing political leaders in Europe taking place shortly before Europeans went to the polls. The recent electoral success of populists and nationalists in both the European Union and Australia are a sure sign that voters are increasingly disillusioned with globalism, open borders, and forced multiculturalism so forcefully promoted by the agents of the New World Order.